books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, we'll travel to Makoko in Lagos with Chioma Okereke's book, Water Baby, plus a chat with Percival Everett about the trees. All that, and we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library, coming up on today's Read On. Chioma Okereke is a poet, short story writer and novelist. Her book, Water Baby, is a coming-of-age story set in the real-life settlement of Makoko in Lagos and portrays the pressures on a young woman trying to escape the confines of her community. I'll talk to the author in a moment, but for now, the audio version of Water Baby is read by Diana Yakini.
There's an old tale where we live about throwing a newborn into the lagoon. If the baby drowns, it is illegitimate and the mother must be banished from the community. But if it floats, the infant is embraced by all. They say fathers used to celebrate their child's birth with this test. It must have been a trick, though, as everybody knows that all babies float. I was born in the water. That's what Papa says, but it's a fiction. I wasn't born in a hospital or on land. Most of us in my community went. We drew our first breaths on Adobo, though according to Papa, my first moments were almost in the lagoon itself. Makoko is what the outsiders had originally called our settlement hundreds of years ago, due to its abundance of akoko leaves, and the name stuck for the community on the Lagos coast, just across the Third Mainland Bridge. To strangers, it's a slum. A metallic and wooden eyesore built over a stinking bed of ever-mounting sewage, spreading out across the smoke-filled horizon. For the government, it's the impediment between even larger coffers for them and prime waterfront real estate. But to us, who are from here, Makoko is simply home.
Water Baby is a coming-of-age tale set in the real-life settlement of Makoko in Lagos, Nigeria, the world's largest floating slum. A 19-year-old baby yearns for an existence different to the one she sees traditionally shaking out around her, which is maybe being married off early or a lifetime smoking fish to sell in the markets and beyond. She's much more enamored with a new initiative that comes into the community, which is a drone mapping project designed to give young women some tech skills and to empower them by mapping the waterways that they live in so they have a better understanding of what is contained in that slum settlement, and also to give them more legitimacy in the eyes of the world, because the government is always trying to displace this community from where they are. Her father, who is from a different generation and has perhaps a longer memory of the skirmishes with the government, is reluctant for her to get involved. But baby sneaks off and does it anyway. And a picture is captured of her in this activity that goes viral. And life as baby knows it changes.
And this drone project was actually a real initiative in Makoko.
Right. So this was a real thing that took place. It was called, I think, Code for Africa Project. And it was very much a real thing that took place within the community to, one, exactly to give some young girls some experience, some tech skills, and to teach them how to fly a drone. And they would go around mapping the community. Makoko, basically a little bit of history about Makoko, which was kind of started off in the 19th century as like a little fisherman's village. It's on the Lagos Lagoon. And there were fishermen from maybe Togo and the Republic of Benin, and it just carried on spreading across the water. Because it's an informal settlement, the numbers there on the internet range from anything between 85,000 to possibly 250,000 people. What we know is that Lagos is, you know, Nigeria's most populous city. So there's really no way to tell how many people are actually living there. But the government is always trying to get rid of people because obviously it's prime waterfront real estate, but there's no way to displace a fishing community too. You can't move them inland. That is, you know, where they rightfully belong. So yes, Code for Africa came in and was hoping that they would map the waterways. Makoko is roughly 6 villages, a third of which are on water and some of them spreading onto the mainland, but map what was going on within those waterways.
A bead of sweat slides through my braids, and I shake my head vigorously to generate some breeze. But my executive passenger frowns at me, as if I'm in danger of rocking the boat. "You're safe, Auntie," I say to reassure her, to soften the ice block I'm ferrying towards the community. But she looks through me before closing her eyes. On a good day, I'll make half a dozen more trips like this before I go home to deal with my chores or to carry out one of my other side jobs. A person must have many other lives on Makoko in order to eat and sleep. But bobbing along on the water in the traffic jams created by other boats or drifting far away with the lights on the horizon for guidance is where I feel the most free. Alone on the water, I can hear my own thoughts without the voices of others telling me what to do or who to be. Many of us set our sights on the mainland. The furthest we can stretch our imaginations before they break. Parents dream of us leaving Makoko and doing better than they did for themselves. And eventually we dream it too, all the while knowing it to be an elusive fantasy. Not many of us have done it, yet that hope pulses within us like a beacon. I gaze longingly beyond the mainland to the skies, and in those moments that are solely mine, I'm free to fantasize about the future. One that I'm actually wanting.
It's a remarkable place, and it was a bit of a rabbit hole I went down doing the research for this. It's a place I'd never heard of, but now I've watched documentaries on it. It's just a fascinating place. The fact that people live in these houses on stilts on the water, yeah, but they also go to school and they go to church. And as Baby says in the book, it's home to them.
It's definitely home to them. And it's just the feat of ingenuity and creativity with which you're able to live a whole and complete life without access to basic social amenities, just trying to find ingenious ways to get clean water, for example, or to get electricity over from the mainland. All these things is absolutely fascinating. But yes, they live whole, you know, they do everything else that anybody else does. It's amazing.
And I believe it was a food show that was the inspiration for this book.
That's exactly right. I was watching, it was during the start of the pandemic, and we were just watching anything and everything on the internet. And the algorithm eventually understood our love of food. And there were just all these food shows popping up. And there was the best ever food review show, something like that, which had a 20-minute episode on Makoko. And I was absolutely fascinated because equally, I was born in Nigeria. My father has always lived in Nigeria and he lives on the Victoria Island. So it's something that I've seen, the community is something I've seen, but only outside the window of my car when I'm crossing the bridge just to go to my father's house. It's not somewhere I'd ventured into. It's not something that I considered in any real way. So I was quite ashamed by that fact. And I was absolutely fascinated by this food program and just watching this American chef go over there to explore the food. And it boggled my mind that I hadn't even thought about doing that myself.
But you have since gone there yourself.
That's correct, yes. So I went, the moment that we could sort of travel again, I went back to Nigeria to see my dad. I organized a trip to the community and I had a fantastic tour guide who arranged certain things, a visit to a school. I had organized with a local bookshop a collection of school books to take to the school. And then when we got there and we met the kids and everything, I mean, it just boggles your mind because I also wanted to visit to ensure that I had captured the community accurately and respectfully, because it's always difficult when you're writing outside of your own experience. But I was just blown away by the size of the schoolroom that is shared by all the children. And I had sort of, you know, with my 50 books, I thought, what am I doing? How is this? How can I actually help? So I felt just so compelled to help beyond the book, which is why effectively set up a charity in the hopes of trying to do that. I'm glad that Water Baby can shine a light on this fascinating community. But it just blew my mind that everything I sort of imagined was coming to life in front of me on the water.
Yeah, there is a charity mentioned at the end of the book. Tell us about Makoko Pearls.
So, I mean, the answer was probably staring me in the face, and readers of the book will realise that once they get to the end. I don't want to give anything away. But I went to visit the community, and I was talking to the tour guide afterwards because I as I said, I just had to do whatever I could, and I couldn't imagine how I could help other than talking about it in any capacity. And he put me in touch with some local organizations, and I started liaising with them to try and understand how to get involved with the community. And I found a couple of organizations that would do occasional work within Makoko, but I couldn't find anyone sort of working in there exclusively. So I decided to set something up that would do just that, because the book shines a light on Makoko. So I set up Makoko Pearls, and the hopes is to work with local organizations, NGOs, and community committee to understand how to benefit the inhabitants of those living inside the community. And hopefully we can help facilitate access to education, access to sanitation services, you know, whatever we can do, we're going to try and do.
Makoko is a fisherman's village, which was how Egun migrants referred to it when it first appeared centuries ago. Now there are many more people from plenty places that have come to make a home within the community. From Benin and Togo, even Ghana, they keep coming. And of course, many of us have been born here. So many tribes living and working side by side, like the Sikeri, who sell fuel and kerosene on the high sea, who also work in the sawmill business, like the Ijale that smoke fish along with the Yoruba and Egun people. The Igbo, my mother's people, smoke fish too, albeit mostly stockfish, as well as producing large numbers of cooked uku and fried groundnuts. The Hausa make very good tailors and also buy iron scraps to make and sell panels. You hear different languages bouncing off the water: Yoruba, French, English, and Egun, eking out of every shack, day and night. Everywhere you look on Makoko, you find workers, craftspeople, artisans making something out of less than nothing, using whatever comes from the water and the ground beneath it, repurposing things that have been thrown away.
Now, the audio version of the book is read by Diana Yakini. Did you have any choice in the narrator?
Yes, I was given a selection of voices, and it's just a gut. It's a gut instinct. So, yeah, her voice is so warm, and she's done so well with other audiobooks that I thought, yeah, I have to go with her.
Now, you're a short story writer and a poet as well, which involves reading out loud. Did you not fancy narrating the book yourself?
I think I would not do it well. Funnily enough, I used to work a very long time ago for Choice FM, so I did a lot of commercials. But I think it's one thing to read a script and another thing to read the book you have written. I mean, every time I look at it now, I'm always correcting it. I'm always overthinking it. So I think it needs someone that's slightly separated from the text to do it justice.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download the book is the cover. Can you give us a little audio description of the cover?
The cover is a beautiful, almost impressionist blue, a deep, deep blue. So it's the lagoon at nighttime with a wonderful moon in the centre of it, which also looks like a Reese Witherspoon's book club sticker if you squint. Baby is sailing out towards perhaps possibly home, or sailing away from home towards the bridge. And it's absolutely stunning.
Is it important that the book is available in accessible formats such as audio so that anyone, no matter what their relationship with print, can access the book?
Yes, I would say so. The way that we ingest books or reading and stuff has changed rapidly, and people seem to have less and less time to read, but equally, I think it's so important that everybody has access to books in any format. I imagine that also listening to a book completely transforms the way the book is written. So it's also a fascinating experience as a writer to listen to an audiobook and to read an audiobook.
Effie begins unpicking my cornrows that I've been in too long and whose formerly crisp lines have now become furry. As I listen to her cracking her chewing gum while she fills me in on the gossip she has ingested from her day's walk, I feel bad because I know something juicy about Idunu. Instead, I press my lips together to stop the story from escaping. The smell of cooking oil floods the salon, even with the door closed, and my mouth begins to water as my nostrils pick up the aroma of stick meat drizzling their fat onto hot flames as they cook along with roasted plantain. "Are you coming on Saturday with us?" Ife stops her activity to briefly confront me. "Coming where?" "I knew you weren't listening," Ife replies, mischievously snagging my hair with the tail comb. "To the protest," she says. "Oh, yes. I don't know," I say, my brain imagining hordes of angry people congregating. "I have to ask Papa," I explain, listening to her blowing the air out of her mouth in exasperation. "Baby, we are all going. It is during the day, so you don't have to ask anything, especially as you know what he will be saying."
Water Baby by Chioma Okereke is available now in print as an ebook and an audio as read by Diana Yakini. And Chioma, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Chioma will be back at the end of today's show with the books of her life. And thanks to Quercus, the book Water Baby is on its way to the RNIB Talking Books Library, where it joins...
A beautiful biographical work has been donated by Canongate. Brother, Do You Love Me? Is by Ruben and Manny Coe.
It can't be morning. I've barely closed my eyes. Slowly, the winter light brings order to my thoughts. I recall my footsteps late last night, crunching the gravel before I turned the key in the front door and dumped my bags. It took me over 3 hours from the airport, driving motorway lanes and dual carriageways before the narrow country tracks. It was like driving inside a tree. The trunk becomes boughs, becomes branches and twigs. Even in the dark, I know every twist and rise of these lanes. Something always lifts in me when I arrive in this quiet valley. I pour boiling water on a tea bag to brew. I carry my two suitcases upstairs and leave them on the floor of our bedroom, under the window with the low sill that looks east over Jess's field. There are her 32 sheep. It's not even 6 a.m. and I need to fill the hours. I pace the length of the living room in socks that pull up dust from the floors. I should clean. I should mop. I empty the fridge of food past its sell-by date and throw away fruit mouldering in the bowl. I need to hoover up the dead cluster flies.
Ruben, age 38, was living in a home for adults with learning disabilities and struggling to accept that he had Down syndrome. Depressed and in a fog of antidepressants, he hadn't spoken for over a year. Increasingly isolated, cut off from everyone and everything he loved, Ruben sent a text message, "Brother, do you love me?" When Manny received this desperate message from his youngest brother, he knew everything had to change. Together they made an extraordinary journey of repair, rediscovering the depths of their brotherhood, one gradual step at a time. Their story of hope and resilience questions how we care for those closest to us and draws a moving portrait of brotherly love.
It's been 3 months since Jack and I were last here. It's been 3 months since I saw Ruben. Before the rain sets in, I go for a walk. Pathways through familiar fields lead me to the village. I buy a coffee from the petrol station and head back with the Sunday papers poking out from under my grey cagoule that I bought in Rome when I took Mum for her 75th birthday. Turning off Anning's Lane, back at the cottage, I check my watch. It's almost time. Do I have everything with me? I don't need anything with me. All I need is hope, but right now that's hard to find. The town doesn't look like itself. Everything is veiled with strangeness. Street lamps cast peaks of light downwards through the fog. Shops on East Street look like a chain of extinct volcanoes. I carry on along West Street and turn off at the traffic lights. Once I've parked the hire car outside the house, I stare up at the white walls and fixate on his bedroom window, facing out onto the street. Does he know I'm here? Can he see me waiting? I notice that the white paint below his sill has peeled and chipped, exposing the concrete render below. At the front door, I press the bell and wait. I can hear the shush of feet against the carpet inside and take a step back. The brass door handle turns and he appears, ushered forward by one of the carers who works in the house. He pauses before crossing the threshold, making sure I'm not a stranger. There is no embrace, only raindrops on white PPE. He shuffles forward as faint as a shadow. On the pavement, I maneuver him into the passenger seat and load his holiday bags into the car. I shut the boot, but before I can get into the driver's side, the carer calls me back to the house. I have to sign for his bank card and something else in a bag.
Brother, Do You Love Me? By Manny Coe. Is read by Manny Coe with Ruben Coe and runs for 9 hours 39 minutes.
For those interested in art, we have Gauguin and Polynesia by Nicholas Thomas, which was donated by Bloomsbury.
Clovis Gauguin lived at a time of economic progress and volatility, controversial technological innovation, acute social inequality, and religious bigotry. Polarized and irreconcilable political ideologies spawned frequent violent uprisings within nations, as well as unpredictable international rivalries and warfare, both within Europe and in territories around the globe, which became theaters of competition between would-be dominant powers. In other words, his world was, notwithstanding many upheavals and transformations since, not so different from our own. Acrimony and turbulence are ever-present features of modern political life, perhaps some might say in France in particular. It is notable that in the 1840s, the equivalent wars of ideas and values had been permanently marked by two revolutions of 1789 and of 1830. The latter saw 3 days of insurrection in late July, which forced the abdication of the reactionary Bourbon Charles X and his replacement by the Duke d'Orléans, who became Louis-Philippe I. The liberal constitutional monarchy then put in place, known as the July Monarchy, was destabilized by ideological struggles and was soon notoriously aligned with the interests of the rich. Cordial relations with Britain were seen to favour the bourgeoisie, hence the offensiveness to republicans and other nationalists of the government's failure to forcefully assert French interests at the time of L'Affaire Pritchard.
The post-impressionist artist and writer Paul Gauguin led an extraordinary, troubled and restlessly itinerant life. He came late to painting and spent most of his last decade in the Pacific islands of Tahiti and the Marquesas, where he produced paintings loosely based on Polynesian tradition that heralded the emergence of primitivism and would exert a profound influence on modernist artists from Picasso and Matisse to Jackson Pollock. But his art, despite its growing popularity following Gauguin's death in 1903, has provoked mixed responses. Although some praise his knowledge and understanding of the Polynesian world, others are censorious, regarding elements of his work as expressions of racism, misogyny, and colonial sexual exploitation, which he is seen both to have engaged in and validated through his art. Nicholas Thomas retells the artist's story for a 21st century audience, giving greater consideration to the Pacific context of his experience and to Pacific perspectives on his art and his legacy.
A lurch toward authoritarianism following food shortages and price rises, among other economic challenges in the mid to late 1840s, compounded the unpopularity of the government. Clovis and Aline's first child, Marie, was born in April 1847. Their second, Paul, arrived just over a year later, a few months after France's third revolution, marked by street demonstrations, fighting at the barricades and the king's hasty flight, and just a couple of weeks before the violent and violently repressed Journée de Juin, or June Uprising. Some axes of the conflict that culminated in France and across Europe in the events of 1848 are familiar. Camps on the left and right had fundamentally different visions of the just division of wealth and what proportion of the adult and male population ought to be entitled to vote. At another level, the political landscape was occupied by a bewildering spectrum of legitimist, radical socialist, communist, republican, liberal, and Bonapartist movements and factions. Political parties were banned, as were rallies or demonstrations, though public banquets, ostensibly collective meals at which speeches could be made, provided cover for mass gatherings and campaigning. Newspapers were the nearest equivalents to political parties, and leading editors at Le National assumed ministries in the Provisional Revolutionary Government of 1848, established following the insurrection of February that year. Clovis Gauguin was presumably too inexperienced to be among those who made the transition from journalism to national leadership. It is a sign of the times and of the political reversal the country soon suffered that not a single issue of Le National from the revolutionary months remains extant in either French or international archives. Clovis Gauguin's contributions may or may not have been credited to him, but unless copies of the paper or other records eventually come to light, we have no sense of his particular perspective or his own role over these momentous months as he and Aline awaited the birth of their son.
Gauguin and Polynesia by Nicholas Thomas is read by Nicholas Thomas and runs for 10 hours 38 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. Enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy a book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
From Africa to Money, Mississippi. For our trip into the Read On archives today, we'll chat to Percival Everett about The Trees, a novel. It was a Sunday Times Fiction Book of the Year, winner of the Everyman Woodhouse Prize for Comic Fiction, and a Sunday Times Novel of the Year. Although the author himself would never actually describe it as any of these things, it has been called a satire, a zombie novel, and a novel of revenge. It's set in Money, Mississippi, a real place where the 14-year-old Emmett Till was lynched in 1955, after being accused by a white woman of making suggestive remarks. Are the lynched dead coming back for revenge on the descendants of those horrible crimes? And can detectives from the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation, the MBI, get to the bottom of the mystery? The audio version of the book is read by Bill Andrew Quinn.
Deputy Sheriff Delroy Digby was driving his 12-year-old Crown Victoria squad car across the Tallahatchie Bridge when he received a call to go to small change. He pulled into the front yard of Junior Malum and saw the man's wife, Daisy, pacing and crying, gesticulating wildly. Delroy had dated Daisy briefly in high school, and it had stopped when she actually bit his tongue. Then he went into the army and became a clerk in the quartermaster's corps. He returned home to Mississippi to find Daisy married to Junior and pregnant with her fourth child. That child was on her hip as she paced now, and the other three was sitting like zombies on the first step of the porch. "What's going on, Daisy?" Delroy asked. Daisy stopped waving her arms and stared at him. Her face was crunched from crying, her eyes red and sunken. "What is it? What happened, Daisy?" he asked. "The room all the way in the back," she said. "It's Junior, Junior. Oh, Lord, I think he's dead," she whispered so the children couldn't hear. "He got to be dead. We all just got back from the big swap meet in the Sam's Club parking lot. The babies ain't seen nothing. Lord, it's just awful."
A clip of The Trees by Percival Everett, read by Bill Andrew Quinn. Percival Everett joined me down the line from his home in L.A. and somewhat reluctantly told me about the book.
Well, I'm probably the last person to offer a synopsis of any of my books, but I'll try. This novel starts in Money, Mississippi, the site of a horrific lynching of a 14-year-old black young man in 1955. It's not about that event, but that is the seed of the event. And we progress from there with the descendants of the perpetrators of that crime. And it's, I've been told that it's kind of a revenge novel. I don't seek to put labels on any of my work, but I can certainly see why someone would say this.
There ain't no more Cain on this present.
And I believe it was a song that was responsible for the spark that began this book.
It's true. It's a traditional song, I should say. It's a very old song called "Ain't No More Cain." And one morning, I was listening to a version of a cover of that song by the American country singer Lyle Lovett, and I was actually moved by it. And some of the things I'd been thinking about fell into place, and so I credit Lyle Lovett's version of that song for the beginning of this novel.
And also the song "Rise Up."
"Rise Up" is a kind of version of that same song. They share some lyrics.
"Rise up, dead man, help me drive my road."
And it was a thought that, why don't these victims start rising up?
I guess in this.
But it's not a zombie book because you don't like zombies.
Well, who likes zombies? Well, I don't know. Again, it's not for me to say. If someone accused me of having written a zombie book, there are people who like zombie books, so I can go with it.
Lynching and humor seem like very odd bedfellows, but it seems to work.
Well, this is America. Who doesn't like a good lynching? I think all of us oppressed, and even those who aren't as oppressed, get through this life by addressing it with some amount of irony. And so that's what's present in the novel.
Now, lynchings aren't really widely known as history in the UK. Is it the same in the US, or is it very much present there?
Well, I suppose one of the things my novel seeks to do is to point out the fact that lynching is not synonymous with hanging. It means mob violence, mob killing. And that very killing has always been and continues to often be sanctioned by the use of police violence. So I equate police murder of people as lynchings as well.
Sanctioned not only by the police, but by society, because there were postcards sent at the time. And
oh, yes. Yeah, it was culturally sanctioned. People would show up in droves to watch a lynching.
And some of those people may still be alive today.
And you wonder what they think of themselves. You know, that was part of the seed of the novel, too. Looking at some of those photographs and seeing some of those smiling white faces, I wondered, what would this man tell his grandchildren with the world changing around him? How would he address this behavior?
Now, one thing I was surprised to discover that the MBI is actually a real organization.
It is. I mean, every state has its law enforcement organizations. Mississippi just happens to be the MBI, which is, you know, sort of inherently funny. not to mention oxymoronic and just ironic.
Now, one thing we don't get if we download the audio is the cover. Tell us about the cover of the book.
Yeah, they didn't. I thought they made a nice cover. Behind the trees is the very long list of names. It's understated. And what the book is as over the top as this one, I think understating as much as possible is good.
And that list of names is Mama Z's archive.
Yes, more or less it is.
And you actually wrote those names out yourself as well.
I did. I did not write out all 4,000 or so that I discovered, but perhaps 1,000 by hand as an exercise to understand what my character, Damon Thruft, was experiencing. He writes them out and then erases them.
Yeah, to metaphorically set them free.
Yes.
Now, it's not only the song that you mentioned at the start of the interview that's through the book. The song Strange Fruit also appears.
Well, yes, it's a very famous song about, not in any way covertly, but quite obviously about lynching, that became famous, performed by Billie Holiday. In fact, the United States government, on one occasion, attempted to prohibit her from singing that song.
Blood on the leaves and blood at the road. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Back to the Booker Prize. What was it like actually being shortlisted?
I don't know, Thursday. It's you know, awards are nice, and it's really wonderful to have the recognition and to think that there will be more readers for my work. But prizes are what they are. It's a decision of a committee, and again, it's nice that someone likes the work, but it doesn't make my novel any worse or any better. It is what it is.
What was it like at the publishers? I know for indie publishers, it can be a bit of a poison chalice when they suddenly get thousands of demands for their book.
Well, I think they're very excited, and that's the part of the award that's I guess the most pleasurable, is seeing seeing the presses do well. I've always preferred independent publishers, because we talk about literature instead of marketing. I won't talk about marketing. My eyes glaze over, and so my publisher, it's not a subject. And they also don't send the reviews, because I don't read them. Once I've published the book, I view my relationship with it as essentially over.
That being the case, you might not be able to answer this, but the audio version's read by Bill Andrew Quinn. Have you heard any of the book?
I heard they sent me the audition, and I thought he was quite good. So I, as with most things with my publisher, I said, whatever you think, but I do like this man's voice. So I assume that it's good throughout. I certainly didn't listen to the entire book, but perhaps a page or so.
My next question was, do you not fancy reading it yourself?
Not particularly. Again, my relationship with the work ends because I'm working on something else. And I don't think about the work much after I'm done with it. So the book is there for someone else to hear or someone else to read. And my participation, I view as over. The reader is the one who really makes the meaning. I supply the book, but all the work gets done by the reader.
Is it important, as far as readers are concerned, that it's available in formats such as audio and braille so people can get it regardless of their relationship with print?
Well, of course. Literature comes out of an oral tradition anyway of telling stories. Stories don't live on the page. It's the most abstract form of art I think we have. The words exist in the ether, in the air. However we receive them is how they are.
Yes, stories existed thousands of years before paper ever did.
Yes.
Okay, Daisy, you stay here. There's something else back there, too, she said. Delroy put his hand on his pistol. What? Somebody. He's dead, too. Must be dead. Oh, he's dead. Gotta be dead. You'll see. Delroy was confused and now more than a little scared. All he ever did in the service was count rolls of toilet paper. He went back to his patrol car and grabbed the radio. Hattie, this here is Delroy. I'm out here at Junior Milam's place, and I think I'm gonna need me some backup.
Percival Everett, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Before we return to Chioma Okereke for the books of her life, let's find some more brand new books entering the Talking Books library.
We have the popular crime author Tana French. Her latest book, The Hunter, was donated by Penguin Random House.
Trey comes over the mountain carrying a broken chair. She carries it on her back, with the legs sticking out round her waist and held over her shoulders. The sky is a blue so hot it looks glazed, and the sun is burning the back of Trey's neck. Even the faint pin-sharp calls of birds too high up to be seen vibrate with heat. The woman who owns the chair offered Trey a lift back with it, but Trey has no inclination to let the woman into her business, and neither the inclination nor the ability to make conversation for the length of a car journey over the potholed mountain roads. Her dog Banjo lollops in wide circles off the path, snuffing and burrowing among the thick heather, which is too brown-edged and heavily scented for July. It makes crisp, rattling sounds as he pushes through it. Every few minutes he comes bounding back to tell Trey, with small happy puffs and moans, what he's found. Banjo is a mutt, black and tan, with a beagle's head and body set on the legs of something stubbier, and he's a lot more talkative than Trey is. He got his name from a banjo-shaped patch of white on his belly. Trey wanted something better for him, but her mind doesn't run easily to fancy things, and everything she came up with sounded like what some sort out of a schoolbook would call a dog. In the end, she left it at Banjo.
It's a blazing summer when two men arrive in a small village in the west of Ireland. They're coming to get rich, but what they bring is trouble. Waiting for them is Cal Hooper, a retired Chicago detective who moved to rural Ireland looking for some peace. He's found it, more or less, in his relationship with local woman Lena and the bond he's formed with tearaway teenager Trey Reddy. As the two men circle the townland with talk of a scheme to find gold in the mountainside, Cal gets ready to do whatever it takes to protect Trey, because one of them is no stranger. He's Trey's father. But Trey doesn't want protecting. What she wants is revenge. Crackling with tension, the hunter explores what we'll do for our loved ones, what we'll do for revenge, and what we'll sacrifice when the two collide.
Cal Hooper, the American who lives down near the village, has Banjo's litter mate and named him Rip. And if a plain name is good enough for Cal's dog, it's good enough for Trey's. Besides, she spends much of her waking time at Cal's place, meaning the two dogs spend much of their time together, and it would sound stupid if they didn't match. Cal's place is where Trey is taking the chair later on. Cal and Trey mend furniture for people, or make it, and they buy old wrecked furniture and fix it up to sell at the Saturday market in Kilcarrow Town. One time they picked up a side table that to Trey looked useless, too little and spindly to hold anything worthwhile. But when Cal went on the internet, it turned out to be almost 200 years old. When they got through with it, they sold it for 180 quid. The chair Trey is carrying has two stretchers and one leg in splinters, like someone gave it the kind of kicking that takes time and dedication. But once she and Cal get done with it, no one will be able to tell it was ever broken.
The Hunter by Tara French, is narrated by Roger Clark, and runs for 16 hours, 25 minutes.
If you're in the mood for something to warm your heart, we have the Sunrise Swimming Society by Rosie Hannigan, which was donated by HarperCollins.
Rosemary adjusted her sun hat and assessed the shape of her yew hedge. She'd already cut back her fruit bushes and was gasping for a cup of tea. Looking over to the far side of the garden, she wondered if Paddy would make his famous tea, but he was knee-deep in the perennial border, dividing the overgrown achillea. It was a job she wasn't keen on doing, so she didn't disturb him. She'd have to make the tea herself. There was heat in the early September sunshine that had only intensified as the day had progressed. Typical of them to have a heatwave just as the kids went back to school. Lauren, her granddaughter, had her first day of secondary school that morning. She'd promised to call in, but so far the evening had been quiet and uneventful. A chattering came from the lake at the end of her garden, and Rosemary turned to see who was making the noise. Three girls in school uniforms were standing by Loch Carra. Rosemary smiled. There was Lauren now, and it looked as if she'd made some new friends. She looked tiny in her new uniform. Her blazer was huge, and her skirt almost reached her ankles. Lauren would do well in secondary school, Rosemary knew. She'd a good head on her shoulders and was good at her studies. Her proud gaze moved on from Lauren to the striking tall girl beside her.
The day Heather, Niamh and Lauren met, they promised to be best friends for life, and that instant connection only grew stronger with their weekly sunrise swims in their stunning local lake. When they left school, they agreed that no matter where their life took them, every year on Midsummer's Dawn, they would meet at their old spot and swim together. Now 15 years later, the tradition has faded away, disappeared in the face of life's realities. In fact, they don't speak anymore, not since that night. But since this summer, they will find themselves back in their Irish hometown and realise that this could be their last chance to recapture what they have lost. Will their return to sunrise swimming heal each of them and help them rekindle the friendships they once treasured?
Heather Moore looked uncomfortable in a blazer that was clearly too small for her. Her hair was messily braided down her back. Rosemary's lips tightened at the sight. Cash and Pippa Moore, her neighbours, had sent their daughter to St. Eta's in second-hand clothes, which was fine. She had nothing against that. Half of her own wardrobe had been thrifted. But the least they could have done was to make sure the clothes fit the girl. A new pair of shoes wouldn't have gone astray either. Rosemary resisted the urge to take the shears to the hedge again, just as every day she resisted the urge to tell Cash and Pippa to take better care of their children. They'd only moved in a little over a year ago, but since then Rosemary had seen enough. Too often had young Heather sat at her kitchen table, demolishing a sandwich as if she hadn't eaten in days. Often she'd sent Heather home with a sandwich for her little sister, and had found posies of wildflowers left on her back doorstep as a thank you. It set her teeth on edge, the way Heather had to take care of herself and her sister. The only one of the three girls who looked in any way properly dressed was Niamh Kennedy, the only daughter of Colm and Mary Kennedy, and the most cared-for child in all of Loch Carra. Niamh's blonde hair shone in the sunshine as she began to remove her shoes. Rosemary frowned. What on earth were they up to? Dropping her shears onto the lawn, she called to Paddy that she'd be back in a minute, and made her way towards the stile at the end of the garden. She'd be at the lake shore in minutes and would find out what kind of messing the girls were up to.
The Sunrise Swimming Society by Rosie Hannigan is read by Shelley Atkinson and runs for 10 hours and 26 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book service and studios. The first Talking Books to be sent to listeners were on LPs made of shellac.
A shellac is like a very thick plastic, and you know, if you drop them, they just shattered, basically. The average length book, let's say 10, 12 hours, so you're talking 10, 15 discs, perhaps. They were stored in very durable boxes with large straps going around them. And those durable boxes held these discs and were sent out by post in the same sort of way as we do now, of course.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally on today's show, a return to Chioma Okereke for a slightly shorter Books of Your Life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
There are many, many books, but I'm going to go late childhood. I've gone with Bonjour Tristesse by Françoise Sagan, which was written in 1954, and it's an absolute classic about a 17-year-old girl trying to understand and control the world around her as her father, who is a devilishly handsome young widow, starts a burgeoning relationship with her late mother's girlfriend. And equally, it's about young love and just a coming-of-age tale. It's absolutely beautiful.
Bonjour Trieste by Françoise Sagan is narrated in French by Cécile Cassel. I found three official audiobooks in French, one in German, and none in English, although there are a number of unofficial English translations available on YouTube. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with again and reread?
I can happily and always curl up with Julius Winsome by Gerard Donovan, which is absolutely brilliant story of revenge and love and utterly atmospheric about a man who lives in a cabin in the frozen wilds of Maine and wakes up one morning and discovers that his dog is dead and has been killed, and sets about to go and seek revenge. And as he does so, we explore his life and his relationships with his family and everything else. And it's an absolutely, absolutely absorbing book.
Unfortunately, Julius Winsome by Gerard Donovan is not currently available in audio in English. There is a German audio version published under the name Winter in Maine. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
Fresh in the mind is Only Big Bum Bum Matters Tomorrow by Damilare Cuckoo, which is actually, I think it's coming out in July of this year. And Damilare's debut, I think, was All the Men in Lagos Are Mad. This is equally as brilliant. It is a funny book where everything breaks loose as 20-year-old Temi announces that she wants to have, I think it's a Brazilian bum lift. She announces that after the funeral of her father in Lagos. And it's about all the reactions to her big news. It's hilarious, but at the same time, it gives such a wonderful portrait of the intergenerational lives of women in Nigeria. It's fantastic.
An audiobook version of Only Big Bum Bum Matters Tomorrow by Damilare Cuckoo is coming soon. So let's have a listen to a clip from her first book, Nearly All the Men in Lagos Are Mad.
Issy, why did you threaten to kill my son? Lokman's mother's voice is soft and her face impassive as always. But you will remember, she never liked or accepted you. She was just indifferent and sometimes it rankled more because you'd have preferred her to hate you. You will never say it, but you blame her and his five elder sisters for over-pampering Luqman. Yes, he was the last child, an only boy, but their coddling contributed to making him lazy, entitled, and impotent in any adversity. Before you answer, Keton, your six-year-old daughter, will wake from her nap in the bedroom, come to the parlor, be scared of the crowd, spy you, and dash to your open arms. You'll hug her, carry her, sniff her neck, and enjoy her dusting powder scent. She'll hug you tightly, as if she knows you are under fire and she wants to shield you. She'll hold you till your heart warms, till you say a silent prayer for wisdom, for peace, for Keton, that her life will be soft and she'll never leave you. You love her too much. It was all for Keton. You will remember your husband when he was pressuring you and trying to convince you, had said, "Do this for Keton." You will look at him and your anger will rise red again. But Keton will rub your face with her cute fingers and calm your soul so you can tell your story.
A clip of Nearly All the Men in Lagos Are Mad by Damilara Cuckoo, which is read by Anawa Buachi and Thabang Makubela. And once again, Chioma, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.